I'd like now to welcome Tova Andrea Wang. She is a senior fellow at Demos and a fellow at the Century Foundation. She's the author of the book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. And today, Election Day, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Happy Election Day.
Thank you. Same to you. So what is voter suppression? What forms does it take, and has it taken historically?
Well, it's taken many different forms over the years. One of the themes of the politics of voter suppression is that there have been a number of tactics that have been used over the past 150 years by political parties to exclude certain segments of the population from voting. And many of the tactics that were being used 150 years ago, in fact, are still happening and being used today just by different people in different situations and different parties. What we're seeing now and have seen throughout history, for example, is the issue of challenging voters at the polls on Election Day or challenging their right to be on the voter registration list. This has been popping up all over the country now during early voting, where you have people from groups such as True the Vote and some of their affiliate organizations challenging people and their eligibility to vote. And we have seen this throughout history, going back to the turn of the 20th century. It spiked again in the 1960s when the Republican National Committee made a national program of doing this kind of activity, and again in 2004, and then again we're seeing it now in 2012. And so that's in the days that have just come before Election Day certainly have been huge issues, and we expect them to come up today as well. There also were before, you know, over the past 2 years, several election laws passed by Republican-dominated legislatures that were meant very obviously to exclude constituencies that tend to vote for Democrats from the voting process, specifically African Americans, Latinos, and young people, through things like voter identification laws, reducing early voting, particularly the Sunday before Election Day, which we saw created huge lines and a lot of controversy, and cutting back on the ability of groups like the League of Women Voters to do voter registration drives in poorer communities. So we've seen all kinds of tactics this year, and again, a lot of them do echo what's happened in the past, except the difference is in our current day, it's really just the Republican Party who has seen it in their interest to pursue these kinds of measures for partisan gain.
What did voting look like in the mid to late 19th century and early 20th centuries, and what was the relationship between vote suppression and the presence of immigrants and African Americans in the pool of people who theoretically could vote?
Right. Well, so back in those days, both parties were doing it, and, you know, Democrats were worse. I mean, of course, you had the Jim Crow laws in the South, where you had literacy tests and poll taxes and all other kinds of tactics to keep people from the polls that virtually eliminated the African-American vote altogether in the southern states. And that was when the Democrats were doing it to Republicans, because at that time the Republican Party really was still the party of Lincoln and was seen as on the side of blacks. But at the same time during that period, you had Republicans trying to disenfranchise Democrats by trying to exclude immigrants. During that time, of course, in the turn of the 20th century, you saw the great immigration waves in this, people going into the cities of the Northeast. And so the Republicans tried to create different kinds of rules to make it harder for immigrants to vote, such as making voter registration much more difficult in urban centers and cities where the immigrants, of course, were living. And again, like today, challenging their right to vote at the polls based on what they looked like and what ethnicity they appeared to be.
When were poll taxes eliminated, and how were they eliminated?
They didn't really completely go away until the 1960s, when legislation was passed, and there was also a Supreme Court case that put it away. But we are seeing today a new version of what I believe is a poll tax, and that is these laws that require people to present government-issued photo ID in order to vote. The states are saying that they're making these identification documents free to anyone who doesn't have it. But the reality is that you need several other kinds of documents in order to get the free ID. such as usually a birth certificate, and it has to be the original, which lots of people don't just have. And the birth certificate can cost $20-$25. It can be a very complicated process to get. You might have to make multiple trips to places. So I really consider that to be a poll tax, and the people who tend to need to get the ID because they don't have ID, such as a driver's license to begin with, are people who are lower income, African Americans, Latinos, and young people, people who don't drive cars, can't afford cars, and their living conditions are such that they don't carry that kind of identification with them. So we are seeing a resurgence of the poll tax today in some ways.
The argument that people in favor of voter ID make is that you need an ID to buy a pack of cigarettes or to rent a video. Why shouldn't you be able to present an ID to vote? What's wrong with that argument?
Well, first of all, buying cigarettes, or I don't think actually anyone rents a video anymore, but to do any of these things are not fundamental rights. I mean, we're talking about the most fundamental right we have in this country, and that is every single person in theory is supposed to have an equal voice in our democracy, in our elections. And that's why you cannot make that comparison. And, you know, it's really such a distraction from the real issue, which is there is a segment of the population, a rather large segment of the population, that does not have this identification. You know, it might not be people that they know, the people who are making these claims who run in their circles, but there are lots of people, for a number of reasons, don't have identification. I mean, you can just imagine, even right now, with Hurricane Sandy having just taken place, that people will have lost their documents and lost all their belongings, perhaps, and not have identification. And if they were to live in a state that required it, they'd be disenfranchised. And that's really wrong.
There is an ongoing battle between those who are worried about voter fraud and those who are worried about voter disenfranchisement. So what is each one, and what is the reality of each of these problems today? How prevalent is voter fraud? How prevalent is voter disenfranchisement?
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people do divide it up that way, and there's some truth to that. But I'm concerned about voter fraud, and I'm concerned about voter suppression. It's just I'm not concerned about the kind of voter fraud that people who are advocating these restrictive measures are talking about. And they know this, that, you know, there are problems with absentee balloting. There, you do see a certain amount of fraud in the absentee ballot process. Not a ton, but enough so that, you know, maybe we should take some additional measures. There are occasions when fake voter registration forms will be filled out. That doesn't mean that fake people are voting, but it creates problems for administrators. Those types of things do occasionally occur, and we should really be concentrating on trying to eliminate those problems. But voter ID laws only would address the problem of someone coming into a polling place and impersonating another voter, which has been shown again and again by study after study, is incredibly rare. And I think, you know, there have been tons of studies of all of the allegations made throughout the country. There have been academic research, but I think the most telling statistic is that during the years of the Bush administration, when the Department of Justice was making it an absolute priority to root out voter fraud and go after voter fraud, and in fact, a few U.S. attorneys were actually fired because they didn't seem to be going after fraud aggressively enough in their states. During that period of time, from 2002 to 2007, they only convicted 86 people in the entire country for any kind of voter fraud, and not a single one of them, in fact, was a case of impersonation fraud at the polling place. So the people who are arguing in favor of these voter ID requirements know very well that that's not solving a problem that exists. There is not impersonation fraud at the polls. And they also know very well, I think, the political leadership that is leading this charge, that there are a number of people who do not have the identification that they're trying to require.
And so, as you say, I mean, voter impersonation and even voter fraud, I mean, those 86 cases, they don't swing elections, whereas disenfranchising students, and students are some of the people who are disenfranchised by voter ID laws, because in some states they don't even accept student IDs, even at state colleges, as IDs, those really can actually make the difference in who wins an election.
No, I mean, for sure, if you're doing a balancing of the two, there's no question that the kind of measures that we've seen passed in these last couple of years would skew the outcomes of elections far more than any of the biggest counts of voter fraud that they can come up with, which is almost none. And you're exactly right. I mean, even the states that have passed these laws, the state themselves, when these laws have been litigated in court, have provided statistics for the courts, and they themselves show hundreds of thousands of people without the kind of ID necessary. For example, in Pennsylvania, when that law went before the courts, the state itself, number one, provided data that 750,000 people in the state did not have the kind of voter ID that they were trying to require. And number two, stipulated in the language of the law, conceded for the purposes of the court action, that there had never been a case of voter impersonation fraud at the polls in the entire history of the state of Pennsylvania. So, you know, it all becomes really rather clear what's happening when you take that into consideration.
We're talking to Tova Andrea Wang about her book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Let's go back a little bit in history again and talk about the ballot. Did we always have in this country a secret ballot?
No, in fact, it's interesting. We take the secret ballot as being so sacred today, and it's such a you know, normal part of how we vote. But back 150 years ago and 120 years ago, actually the parties printed the ballots, and they would provide them to their supporters. And, you know, in those days in particular, there were lots of people who weren't literate, and then there were people who were immigrants who didn't speak English well, and they could tell by the color of the ballot which one they wanted to cast, and it made it very easy for them. And in fact, the idea of the government creating and issuing the ballots and them being a private secret ballot only came a bit later, and it originally was another attempt among some people to make it more difficult for poorer people to vote. That was its original genesis. Now, today, of course, we take it for granted that everyone is entitled to a secret ballot, a private ballot, and we've been made the, I think, correct analysis that the dangers of somebody using some kind of coercion or influence, if you don't have a secret ballot, is more risky than someone perhaps not being able to navigate the ballot as easily. And we've made provision for that as well, because people who are unable to read or have language difficulties are allowed to have assistance at the polls. So we've made some accommodation to that as well.
Let's talk about voter registration. How did voter registration begin, and what were and what are issues with registration?
Well, again, there was a time in our history that there wasn't voter registration, and it really did start, again, as a way to make voting more difficult for some people. It became, for the first time, a two-step process. You had to go and register, and then you had to also go and vote. And for working people, this all had to be done during the week. It was incredibly difficult, and still is. And they played around with the registration rules back then the same way they're doing now. For example, I was talking about earlier that they tried to make it harder for immigrants in the northern cities to vote. Well, another way that they did it, which I mentioned earlier, was they would make registration ahead of time mandatory, but only in cities over a certain size, knowing that's where immigrants were concentrated. So that's the kind of tactic that they would use in that case. In the South, it was even more blatant than that. I mean, local registrars would just simply deny African Americans the ability to register at their own discretion. And we see, again, today, rules around the registration system that are meant to disenfranchise and make it more difficult for people to register, which is necessary for voting. For example, Florida, which is always our favorite state at this time of the year, passed the law, among others, that made voter registration drive so risky that the League of Women Voters and Rock the Vote and other groups like that just shut their operations down. Basically, the law required that if you did not turn around your voter registration forms that you had collected in 48 hours, you were liable to fines of up to $1,000. And groups decided that they could not afford to make themselves vulnerable to that kind of liability and just shut down. And as a result, the voter registration numbers in Florida are much lower this year than they had been in the prior two election cycles, especially among Democrats, because these groups conduct their voter registration drives in communities of color and lower-income communities where people have less access to other opportunities to register to vote. You know, as a general thing, and I think that this can be something that people on all sides of these issues can agree upon, is that the voter registration system in our country is entirely antiquated. With the technology that we have now, it's ridiculous that we have people writing down on paper in legible or not legible handwriting the information, and then that's being transcribed into a database that is then being incorporated. We need to have a much more streamlined system where it's much easier for people to get on the registration rolls and where we increase the possibility of government agencies putting people on the registration rolls rather than the people having the burden on them to register, because that's how it's done in most other countries. In all the other countries in that are Western democracies, it's really the government's responsibility to make sure everyone is on the voter registration list. And you see voter turnout numbers in other countries much, much higher than in the United States because registration has become such a barrier.
Are there any other industrialized countries that have the kind of problems and issues that we have with voting?
Well, I mean, there are, and other countries have their own problems, of course. I mean, they, you know, in some places, the voter fraud and the cheating and the suppression and the exclusion is much more blatant, and can even be violent. So we're doing well as far as that goes. But in Western Europe and other countries in the West, you really don't see this kind of activity going on that I have observed. There are issues with identification documents in both Africa and Latin America, with certain communities, ethnic minorities, and indigenous groups not having the identification documents that they need. So that is a global problem. But you really don't see this level of polarization in the countries, in Western countries particularly, that I've observed. But, you know, there may be cases that I'm not aware of, but that's my observation.
What happened in 1920 when women got the vote? Once we had the vote, did it go smoothly? Did they try to disenfranchise us?
Well, that's not something that I really went into great detail in the politics of voter suppression, because there was a period in the 1920s to about the 1950s that was a pretty quiet time in terms of the issue of trying to exclude people from the vote. The Jim Crow laws were still in existence, but we were in a period of course, women getting the vote and the franchise becoming more expansive, and that was certainly one aspect of that. But at the same time, the movement for civil rights among the African-American community was building and started to culminate in the 50s and 60s, which led to the dynamics that you have with respect to voter exclusion today.
How did the Democratic Party go from being the party of voter suppression in the South to the party being favored by African-Americans?
Right. So as I was beginning to describe, in the 1960s, and it had started earlier with the New Deal and the programs that were set up during that era by President Roosevelt, that African-Americans started trending more towards the Democratic Party. But then in the 1960s, when you did have the Civil Rights Movement and the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, you increasingly had the Democratic Party becoming the party associated with civil rights and with the rights of African Americans. And so the parties really switched in some ways, and that switch was pretty much complete at all levels of government by the 1980s. And that's the reason why you see today and over the last several decades that Republicans have been trying to exclude African Americans and now more recently Latinos and young people from the voting process because they, as of today, vote incredibly overwhelmingly for Democratic candidates, about 95%. And so it was gradual, but there certainly was a turning point in the 1960s when it became clear that the Democratic Party was the party that was more inclined towards supporting civil rights.
I have to say, I mean, reading your book just reminds me once again, as I'm reminded so often, that our country, the story of our country seems to be the story of ongoing pathological racism. It's really, I mean, it's the reality, but it's really hard to take. It's so awful. How do you understand it?
Well, I don't understand it. I mean, of course I don't understand it. But throughout this period, race has always also overlapped with partisanship and also with class. And so I don't know the degree to which what is happening now is a matter of racism or a simple matter of African Americans will vote 95% for Barack Obama. It's hard to really disentangle these things, and it always has been because there has been this overlap. But you can't ignore that certainly race is playing a role here, as it is, you know, throughout the election and the campaigns.
And I mean, certainly, a lot of people who are going to vote, a lot of white people who are going to vote for Romney, their economic interests would probably not be well served by his policies.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit outside of my jurisdiction, but, I think that people are going to vote on a variety of different issues and what their sensibilities are. But the concern here is that they be able to vote without any problems, without anybody challenging them at the polls, without anyone giving them any misinformation, people knowing their rights, knowing that if they do not speak English well, that they are entitled to have assistance at the polls, that there should be in certain communities people who are there to assist people who don't speak English well, that they, if they're challenged, they still have a right to vote. People should be educating themselves before going to the polls so that they make sure that they are able to vote no matter who they're going to vote for.
We're talking to Tova Andrea Wang about her book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. So tell us about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. What did it actually do?
Well, it really knocked down all the Jim Crow barriers to voting that had been in existence for the 100 years prior to that, such as any kind of discrimination at the polls and the poll taxes and the literacy tests and all of these kinds of tactics that had been used during that period. And so it really was a watershed. But as we've been discussing, the fight has not ended. That certainly did not put an end to different types of tactics to try and exclude African Americans from voting. They just had to become a little bit more sophisticated, which they have. Again, one of the main tools that has been utilized by the Republicans to deny African Americans the right to vote is this issue of challenging people and also trying to throw people off the voter registration list. And so the Voting Rights Act is an incredible tool, and in fact, this year it came into play in a very strong way as some states passed voter ID laws that were found to be incredibly discriminatory. They did not pass review with the Department of Justice. There are certain jurisdictions in the country that have to get approval from the Department of Justice or the D.C. Circuit Court in order to make a change in their voting procedures. And both in South Carolina and in Texas, both the Department of Justice and the courts found that these voter ID laws were, in fact, discriminatory against African Americans and Latinos, and that hundreds of thousands of people would likely be denied the right to vote by these laws. And so the Voting Rights Act was a very powerful tool against voter exclusion this year.
And so were people who would have been excluded now going to be able to vote?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, at the end of the day, it's really quite incredible. A couple of dozen states tried to pass voter identification laws this past couple of years, and at the end of the day, only four states will be actually implementing this year strict government-issued photo ID laws, Tennessee, Kansas, Georgia and Indiana. All of the other ones, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, South Carolina, Texas, they were all blocked by the courts or by the Department of Justice, and several others were vetoed by governors. The numbers have just become incredibly clear that there are hundreds of thousands of people in each of these states that don't have the ID required and wouldn't be able to get them. The process has not been created by which people can easily get these IDs that they want them to have in order to vote. And the courts and the Department of Justice have rightfully found that these, while they're discriminatory because it's disproportionately African Americans and Latinos who don't have the ID, and that they trample on the fundamental right to vote.
There was a law that was passed in 1993, the National Voter Registration Act, also called Motor Voter. What was that all about?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story that I describe in The Politics of Voter Suppression about the fight between Republicans and Democrats in the late 1980s and early 1990s over, again, making voter registration more accessible to people. As I mentioned, voter registration has been a huge battleground in the right to vote. And basically, the Motor Voter Bill, there were several versions of it that went back and forth, but it was meant to make it make voter registration available at departments of motor vehicles, so when you went to get your driver's license renewed or had any exchange there, you would be able to register to vote, that you would be able to register to vote by mail, which allowed for the voter registration drives that so many of us count on now to register to vote and re-register to vote. And another section of it that most people don't know about is that it required that, as well as the DMV, public assistance agencies also provide voter registration services, because there was an understanding from the research that had been done that lower-income people were much less likely to have transactions at the DMV, and this was a way of making registration as accessible to lower-income people as for middle and upper income people. And the Republicans in Congress during that period tried to block it every step of the way, because they believed it would make it easier for Democratic leaning constituencies to register through this public assistance agency provision. And in fact, the first President Bush vetoed it. And it went back and forth in Congress with the Republican members making all sorts of allegations about how it would open up the system to fraud and all these kinds of things that were really, as we've seen today, a canard to, oppose a measure that would make it easier for people to participate. And it finally did pass when President Clinton became president. And even after that, a number of Republican governors around the country continued to oppose the law, refused to implement it, or sued, and also sued the government for claiming that it was violating states' rights, which was, of course, a controversial way to phrase it. And eventually, the courts upheld the Motor Voter Bill, and it led to hundreds of thousands and millions of people becoming registered to vote. And actually, at the beginning, especially, Republicans were found to have made use of the Motor Voter Bill more than Democrats. So the whole thing was really, in a way, absurd. But you even have some people on the right who continue to oppose Motor Voter, claiming that it creates opportunities for fraud when it really has not whatsoever.
It does seem to address the problem that you were talking about earlier, namely if people are registering at their motor vehicles departments, they are in a system where it's not about writing illegibly on paper forms that then have to be transcribed. It goes straight into the system.
Well, it depends. I mean, there actually have been problems with that, too. Sometimes you have problems with the DMV transmitting it to the proper elections officials, so that's not been a perfect system either. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely better than, other ways of doing it. And that's why many organizations, including the organizations that I work for, are very in favor of the idea of automatic registration, which I was referring to earlier, where the government takes more responsibility for putting people on the voter registration list rather than forcing people to constantly register and re-register every time that they move out of a jurisdiction.
Let me ask you this. Who votes and who doesn't vote? I mean, you don't have to vote. Some countries you do. Here you don't. What are the demographics of people who choose not to vote?
Well, I mean, choose not to vote is, you know, one question. Are not able to is another question.
I mean, choose not to vote.
Right. There is undoubtedly a group of people in this country who I think understandably are cynical and disengaged and really have lost, I guess, a lot of respect for the ability of anything good to come out of politics. And that's a sad commentary on the state of our politics today and the way that our politicians are acting and behaving and or not doing things. But then you add to that structural barriers that then make it more difficult for these people to engage should they choose to at some point or at least consider doing it. And, you know, it makes it that much worse. And people are sent the message that their vote is not valued and their voice is not valued when there are, in addition to all of the political games that are played, when there are people who are trying to prevent you from voting and think you shouldn't have the right to vote out there. It sends a terrible message on top of everything about how much people's voices are valued. And I think that the message is definitely being sent to lower-income people and communities of color, that somehow, that voting is a privilege that somehow hasn't been earned. And I fundamentally disagree and object to that way of thinking about voting.
It turns out, which I thought this was so interesting in your book, it turns out that voting is habit-forming.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of research has found that once somebody votes for the first time, they will tend to vote more often and continue to vote in elections after that. It is habit-forming. I think that there is a lot of trepidation the first time someone goes to vote. And actually, every time you go to vote, it seems like, a little intimidating. But once you get over that first hump, it is true that people will continue to vote. And in fact, another interesting aspect of that is that you will tend to continue voting the way you voted the first time for the same party in general. And so that's one of the reasons that it's so important that we get young people to participate more so that it becomes habit forming throughout their lives. And that is also why it's so incredibly sad that a political party and certain candidates would be seeking to try and make it harder for young people to vote. I think that's a bad long-term political strategy, frankly, and it's also, of course, bad for democracy.
We're talking to Tova Andrea Wang about her book, The Politics of Voter Suppression. So let's talk about caging. What is caging?
Caging, the specific definition is that it's when a group or an individual will send postcards or mail to a certain community that they have pre-selected, and any of the mail that comes back as undeliverable, they will use that as some kind of evidence that the person is not eligible to be on the voter registration list and challenge their right to be registered, or they will use those names as a list to challenge people on election day. And it's a really incredibly pernicious practice because a piece of mail being undeliverable is a terrible way to determine whether someone is rightfully on the voter registration list. There are all sorts of reasons that someone could have their mail be undeliverable from someone being in the military and being posted overseas and temporarily not being at that address, to people, especially these days with the economic crisis, living in multiple family homes where they don't get mail in their own names, and so it would be undeliverable. And so it's been consistently found that using that as a method for weeding out people who shouldn't be on the list is incredibly inaccurate, and groups tend to target these mailings to minority communities as a way of coming up with lists to challenge people.
Well, and as you write, I mean, sometimes they have purposely used old lists that had old addresses on them, and people moved six blocks away, the mail comes back, and they're taken off the voter registration rolls.
Well, and we're seeing this right now. Truth of Vote around the country, this is a Tea Party affiliated organization, has been mounting challenges to people's right to be on the registration list across the country over the last few months. And they've been using data such as using Facebook as a way of trying to determine whether someone is eligible to vote or not, using all sorts of incredibly inaccurate methods for matching people's names and addresses to the voter registration list. And all it's been doing has been creating more headaches and more work for already overly stressed election administrators, because the election administrators are just tossing this all out because they're ridiculously flawed. And the people who are on them, who they're trying to challenge and force to come down to the Board of Elections and prove that they're eligible, are people who are perfectly legitimate, eligible American citizens who are properly on the voter registration list. And so they're really creating a lot of problems for everybody involved.
Now, hang on a second. The Tea Party is a private group of citizens. Facebook is a company. It's a corporation. What does either one of those people have to do with challenging voters? I mean, they're not officials.
Well, I mean, you know, Facebook is an innocent party in all of this, but I agree. It is unfortunate but true that under the laws in most states, it is very easy to challenge someone's eligibility to vote at the polls. We at Demos advocate very strongly for these laws to be strengthened so that you at least have to have evidence that the person should not be able to vote or have some kind of personal knowledge as to why that person should not be able to vote, and there should not be laws that basically allow any other voter to challenge another voter's right to vote without really showing that there's any basis for it. You know, going forward, I think that's going to be a big thing that we concentrate on to try and push back on these methods of trying to deny people the right to vote and intimidate and harass them.
But in other words, in most states, you're saying that a private citizen or a private group can legally challenge somebody's right to vote?
Well, the laws vary tremendously by states, but there are certainly some states where that is the case, that another voter can challenge the eligibility of another voter in the polling place. Then in other states, in most states, actually, you have appointed poll watchers who have the right to challenge people's right to vote. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people believe that it really should only be official poll workers who have the right to challenge someone because, you know, it really creates havoc, and you should leave it to people who are trained in all of this to determine whether somebody is properly on the list and should be voting, and not individuals and groups who may have some other kind of agenda going on.
Most of us remember the debacle of the 2000 presidential elections with the hanging chads and the butterfly ballots and many, many thousands of eligible voters disenfranchised in various states, including in Florida, and the whole election being decided by the Supreme Court and votes not being counted and then being counted later. I mean, you know, all of this gave rise to, first of all, a lot of awareness about voting that we really maybe hadn't had on a large scale before, and a legislative response, which was the Help America Vote Act. What did this legislation do, and what have been its effects?
Well, one thing it did, which was very helpful, was for the first time, and this is kind of amazing, for the first time the federal government provided resources, money, for elections. In the past, up until just, you know, 10 years ago, the states and localities had been completely responsible for paying for our election system. So for the first time, Congress allocated some money to strengthen the voting system. It also required that the voting machines have certain adhere to certain requirements, and it basically got rid of the punch card ballot machines that we saw in Florida that were so troublesome. And then another thing that originally seemed like it was going to be very helpful was that it required that anyone who came to the polls and was on the and was found to be not on the registration list had to be afforded a provisional ballot, so that nobody would be turned away from the polls without having cast the ballot. The problem that ensued afterwards was that Congress had not told the states whether they had to count them or not, or how they had to count them. So what several states did is that they would allow people to cast provisional ballots, but depending on the reason why they had cast that provisional ballot, they would just throw them away. And we're still having that this year. There are several swing states where if you go to the polling place and you are misdirected to the wrong table, and so you vote at the wrong precinct, essentially, your provisional ballot that you will be asked to cast will be just thrown out, even for the presidential election. And that nobody had, a lot of people, I suppose, had not anticipated that, because the law uses the word, it should be counted in the jurisdiction, which people had from previous election laws considered to be the county. And nobody really thought that if you were in the wrong precinct, which, as I said, could be just the wrong table within a polling place, that they would just throw the ballot out. But that's what we're going to see in several states. And this was actually, and is still being litigated in the state of Ohio, where the Secretary of State there has been doing everything he can to make sure that provisional ballots won't be counted this year.
Let's talk about this election. We're talking to Tova Andrea Wang about the politics of voter suppression. Where have we seen voter suppression in the United States in 2012 so far in early voting, and what does it look like?
Well, we have seen occasions of challenges to people in Florida and Ohio, not surprising there. We also have had people getting phone calls in a number of states telling them that they are able to vote by phone, which of course is false. In North Carolina, there's been several incidents at polling places during early voting that has the Board of Elections has actually put out a memo alerting people to what is appropriate in the polling place and what is not because of that. There also, they've had incidents of people being told the wrong day to vote. These are the kind of, you know, intimidation and deceptive practices, as we call them, misinformation campaigns that we see every year, at least for the last several election cycles, and it's been no different in 2012. Some of the tactics that they originally tried to deploy were beaten back, and in fact, you know, the people who are in favor of the voters and voting rights had a number of victories before early voting began. To ensure that people would not be disenfranchised. Although we did, of course, as a result of the governor of Florida pushing forward a law that cut back on the days of early voting and particularly targeted the Sunday before Election Day, when everybody knew that it had become a tradition in African-American churches that they would have their church service and then as a congregation the Sunday before Election Day go as a group to go and vote in an early voting location, and they cut that day off very, very consciously. As a result, we saw over the weekend and on Monday incredibly long lines, up to 7 hours. People were waiting to vote in places like in the Miami area and elsewhere in Florida, and which is totally unacceptable. And it is a direct result of the effort to cut back on early voting days. And so that's been incredibly troubling.
I was just reading an article about some robocalls that went out in Democratic districts in Massachusetts telling people that Election Day had been changed to Wednesday because of the hurricane.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's the first time I'm actually hearing about that. But, you know, again, it's not, this is not a new tactic. This has been happening for the last several years, and it's just, it's very important that the response to that be getting out the accurate information right away. And I think, you know, election administrators over the last few years have become quite savvy about this kind of stuff. And everybody has really, I think, caught up to these kind of tactics and are very good about making sure that people know that this isn't true and that they are being, you know, this is misinformation, and getting the accurate details out to people. But while that, you know, is in a way shocking, it really kind of shouldn't be, because we've seen it before.
You work for the Century Foundation and for Demos, and I wonder if there's any discussion going on anywhere, because it seems to me that if you have a partisan election for example, a Secretary of State, the Secretary of State of whatever state is in charge of elections, it's a setup for partisan manipulation. I mean, is there any movement to change who is in charge of the voting apparatus and the voting rolls and all of that?
Right. Well, there is. I mean, it really is kind of crazy that we have people who are implementing our elections are themselves partisanly elected people. And so you get these highly political, highly partisan individuals in places like Florida and Ohio and Colorado, where the Secretaries of State this year have proven to be incredibly focused on politics and partisan gain, and using the system for partisan gain. And it really makes no sense. There are all sorts of conflicts of interest. And you even have some of these people as Secretary of State, whether they're running for re-election or sometimes running for another office, overseeing their own election. And so there are a lot of people who believe that we should be trying to introduce some kind of nonpartisan structure to the implementation of our voting system. But, you know, it really hasn't had a lot of traction. I think people are very skeptical as to whether there's anything anyone left in this country who can be nonpartisan, but somehow countries around the world have nonpartisan election commissions that operate and function quite well and that people have confidence in. You know, when you have a highly polarizing figure who's a politician running an election in your state or in your locality, that person starts out with a certain number of people being highly suspicious of everything they do. And unfortunately, in some cases, like the ones I alluded to just now, their worries are borne out. And it would be great if we could start having the conversation about having nonpartisan election officials. And I absolutely think that is something that we will pursue going forward.
What states today have, in your view, the best and worst practices in terms of having both an accurate and a fair and an inclusive vote?
Well, there are a number of states. Now I think there are 11 states that have it on the books, but only 9 or 10 that have it this year. But there are several states that have same-day registration. That, I think, is the single biggest reform of the election law that states can make to increase political participation. The 10 states that have same-day registration every single election year have the highest turnout rates in the entire country, without exception. They usually have voter turnout rates that are in double digits higher than the other states. And some of these states have had these systems for some 20 years, and they work incredibly well, allowing people to register and vote on the same day. It is the one structural change I can, with complete confidence, say will increase voter turnout. And in fact, there have been studies done that have shown that if every state had same-day registration, that the participation rate in this country would be about 6% higher, and that's a whole lot of people. And so that's something that the states that have that, and there are a bunch of them across the country, that's really the best system that we have right now for increasing participation and making the ballot accessible. I think the states that have challenge laws that make it very easy for anyone to challenge someone else to vote is troublesome. I think that states where you do have a very partisan person in charge of the elections, like in Florida and Colorado and in Ohio, creating rules where they are clearly meant to disenfranchise, that's troublesome. Certainly making it difficult, as they have in Florida, for people to conduct voter registration drives to the point where they can't do it at all is not a good practice. So that's a few that I would point out.
Tova Andrea Wang is author of the book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. She's a senior democracy fellow at Demos and fellow at the Century Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us today, Election Day, on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. My pleasure.